Messiah's Branch Broadcast, a one-hour prophecy program on the American Voice Radio Network, featuring Pastor Dan of the Messiah's Branch Ministry. And now, here's Pastor Dan.
Greetings, saints, and welcome to the Messiah's Branch Prophecy Hour. We are broadcasting live from the Flint Hills of Kansas, and we're on the American Voice Radio Network. Today's date is August 24th, 2017. In turmoil, most just do not realize it, but we are in that time at the end, and that's the time before Messiah's glorious return. So it's time to get out of sin, the world, and look to the holy city. Look to the one who suffered and died for you. Hear the sound of the shofar. Heed the warning. Get right now before it's too late. Please make this choice tonight. If you need help after the program, call me. I'll pray for you or with you. If you get the machine, please leave your name, your number, your prayer request, and or message. The phone number, of course, is 620-878-4682. In an emergency, my cell phone number is 316-619-4886. Now, you can always find updates with the breaking news, Wichita Mission Church, radio program archives, contact information, all this at our ministry hub, which is very simply prophecyhour.com. That's prophecyhour.com. Remember, prayer requests can be sent by United States Postal Service and by email with your return address and your phone number, should you choose to do so. These requests will be taken to Wichita Mission Church, anointed with oil, prayed over, and if you want, again, if you wish them, they'll be sent back to you with no request for solicitations or donations. Or as my wife says, I mail it and I lose the address. We have a prayer request form or just a contact form on the right-hand side of Prophecy Hour and MessiahsBranch.com pages. Now, we are a national satellite radio program, which is simulcast live on the internationally, YouTube, right now live, and on some FM stations. So pray about supporting airtime. And on another note, let's thank our listener, Blaze, is worldwide in places like Kampala, Uganda, Bangkok, Thailand, Prague, Czech Republic, Antwerp, Belgium, Vancouver, Canada, and of course cities in the good old United States such as Raleigh, North Carolina, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Corpus Christi, Texas, Las Vegas, Nevada, Phoenix, Arizona, Washington, D.C., and as well as Wichita, Kansas, which remains the largest group of listeners to our radio programs, at least when they go to podcasts later on tonight. Now, prayer. Your Heavenly Father, in Yeshua HaMashiach's name I pray. Father, I really pray that radio tonight goes according to your will, and not my will, nor guest will, Father. But please give everyone out there what you want them to hear. So please, Father, give everyone ears in which to hear the truth. In Yeshua HaMashiach's name, amen and amen. Well, we have a really, really interesting program for you tonight. John Clausen is a man who grew up believing he was the son of an IBM salesman. Though the family moved often and John's father, Wallace, rarely spoke of his work, his family never questioned him or seemed to notice that the inconsistencies and oddities apparent in their daily life. Only decades later, while in his mid-30s, did John finally learn the truth from his father as he was dying of cancer. For over 40 years, being an IBM salesman was just a cover. Wallace's real job with IBM's covert federal systems group, where as a mathematical and mechanical savant, he took his orders from the Department of Defense and was charged with ensuring America's arsenal of nuclear missiles hit their target. Over a span of 3 days, he and his father built a backyard fence, and John learned of his father's hidden story, how Wallace had been recruited from an Iowa farm due to an error in a high school textbook. He learned of a meeting with Einstein and about his father's role in the Cold War and NASA and Iranian missiles. Stunned into silence and left to question the entire fabric of his youth, John wanted only to forget his father's words. In fact, for the next 15 years, he never spoke about what his father had confessed over that very unusual weekend. But he couldn't truly forget. Upon his father's death, John was given his father's workbench, which contained a hidden packet of business cards. Wallace's final plea was to have his story told thus the journey towards discovering the extraordinary clandestine life and career of Wallace Clawson began. Tonight, we talk with Wallace about his new book published by WorldNet Daily called Missile Man, The Secret Life of Cold War Engineer. Well, Wallace, are you there with me? Welcome.
This is his son, John.
Oh, well, I'm okay. So, I'm sorry, John.
Quite a span of time when my father had flown out from Seattle, and he said, "John, it's time that we build the fence." And he actually remembered that the number of sections of fence to buy, the posts, all the support pieces that needed to be procured. So when he landed, we were ready to work. And
go ahead.
Well, it started when I picked him up at the airport in Philadelphia. And if you know Philadelphia at all, the main freeway through town is called Interstate 95.
Right.
While we're leaving Philadelphia, you come to an exit called Broad Street, where there are a lot of professional athletic team coliseums. You know, they call it the Broad Street Bullies back in the 70s with the Flyers. And my dad very pensively looked down that street and he goes, "Johnny, 10 men sat in the basement of a YMCA and decided how bombed the nuclear arsenal was going to be deployed, whether it be in missiles, silos, balloons, trains." In other words, they were exploring all capabilities, and my father's responsibility was to fly balloons out of Lakehurst, New Jersey, where the infamous Hindenburg blew up.
Mm-hmm.
And while he told me about the 10 men in the basement of the YMCA, he started off with naming there was Enrique Fermi. Now, I had heard of that name. He's quite well known in the nuclear world. But then he started naming all the other names, and he got to the ninth person, and he says, "Johnny, I can't remember his name, but he was a gentleman from Georgia." And then I said, "If you can't remember the ninth guy, you're never going to remember the tenth." And he goes, "No, Johnny, that's the easiest. It's your father."
Wow.
And needless to say, I just about drove off the freeway.
I would imagine. There's a question that I want to ask you before we get deep into this that I put here in my notes. Number one, you find out that he was a nuclear engineer that kept the nuclear missiles going. At that time, probably then and now, you may even have two different thoughts on that. How do you feel personally about nuclear weapons then and now? I mean, were you against them, shocked? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Well, here's the challenge with nuclear power. Once it's discovered and it's mathematically proven, it's very tough to shove science back in the genie. And literally, that's what they tried to do once the bomb had been dropped. Einstein, Oppenheimer, Fermi, they said, "We've got to quit this. We've got to shove it back in the genie bottle." And my father was in a different camp that basically said, "You can't shove the science back in the bottle." He goes, "But us nuclear, quote-unquote, nerds or scientists have to learn how to control it, because if the military just runs with it, we know it can happen. Obviously, they dropped two bombs in Japan."
Right.
So once the science was discovered, it's almost inevitable it's going to be developed. And I've often thought about what would have happened if the world would have not developed the nuclear chain reaction. But remember, a lot of good has come from it. Nuclear medicine, a lot of science. But the destructive capabilities of it are is just almost incalculable, because what the bomb we dropped in Japan is called a fission bomb. A thermonuclear device is what you call a fusion bomb, and the way I usually think of it is this. The word fission, I, is incredible. F fusion with a U is unbelievable. And that's 1,000 times more powerful. If a fusion, mid-sized fusion bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it'd be a carbon beach. There would be no mass left. It would all have been vaporized within, a 10 to 15 mile radius. They're that powerful. So the world has not really experienced a thermonuclear blast because the destruction, as my father said when the Russians went to DEFCON 2 in that Abel Archer exercise when he was living in England, he looked at me and he says, "Johnny, I thought I could have been vaporized." Now, just imagine that. You'll never forget your father telling you he could have been vaporized.
Yeah, that's incredible. And you jumped into Abel Archer, so you might as well go ahead and explain that now, because I was going to ask you about it. That was an incredible, I read that along, and there's things in there I didn't even, had no idea about. Back to you.
Yeah, let's turn the clock back to the late 70s.
Okay.
In the late 70s, the Russians literally were on kind of on a roll. They had invaded Afghanistan, and they were really being an aggressor in various parts of the world. Not only had they now invaded Afghanistan, they had placed what you call very accurate SS-20 nuclear missiles that are on trucks and moving silos. So it's not like it's a hard target where you can put a code in to find. They're mobile.
Right.
So they had all these mobile SS-20 missiles along the border of Europe. So under President Carter, they started to arrange to have more missiles brought over for NATO. Well, we know what happened in 1980. Ronald Reagan became president. And not only did he bring them over to Europe, but he was very vocal about bringing them. He goes, "Look, this is what I'm doing." And you can actually go on YouTube and look at all the riots when the Germans found out that we had big Pershing missiles brought into Germany. And my father was responsible for 160 cruise missiles that were brought into England to Grenham Commons. And they had marches and protests all around that because it was well known that we had a variety of missiles there. So we do an exercise annually, but this time this one was different. The exercise consisted of us telling the Russians, "We're going to attack you, but we're just going to be testing out our computer systems and our communications assets." And the Russians did not believe it. They thought it was a ruse. They had already started a couple of programs looking at communications and did they think the price of blood supplies in cities that could have gone to nuclear war, the prices would be going up. It was called Operation Rion. That's a nuclear attack in Russian.
Mm-hmm.
Then he called them the evil empire, remember? Then he threatened them with Star Wars. They wouldn't be able to get an offensive missile off if we wanted, if what we claimed actually worked.
Right.
We actually then invaded Grenada. That'd be like the British invading the U.S. Virgin Islands and not telling the President of the United States. That's what Ronald Reagan did to Grenada and forgot to tell Margaret Thatcher, or did it so intentionally. She was quite upset about that. So the Russians thought this guy was a wild, wild, wild west guy. And they actually had the President of the United States in the exercise. That's why they were so paranoid. As you know, the President carries the nuclear football, and it's the codes, and those codes would go to a computer entity. Obviously, the Federal Systems Group verifies the codes, and then it disseminates it and relays it to what silos get the code. Well, the exercise starts, and the Russians are absolutely assured that they're going to get nuked. They go to DEFCON 2. DEFCON 2 means this. They are expecting nuclear war. They had nuclear bombers around. They deployed their big submarines ready to fire. Well, the 7th, 8th, and 9th is when the actual we tell Russia, here comes our attack. Now, needless to say, we didn't attack, and my father was instrumental in making sure that the computer systems were not live. You can't have one stray computer control system with a live nuclear missile and you fire it. You have to ensure that it's all down. Well, right. At the end of the exercise, a double agent who was working for us under the name of Oleg Gorskievsky, he tells basically William Casey, the head of the CIA, do you have any idea how close you came to getting nuked? And he goes, what do you mean? He goes, they had gone to DEFCON 2, and we had already unhooked our systems. We were like at DEFCON 4 or 5. In the history of nuclear age, there's only been one time when they're at DEFCON 2, and we didn't even know about it.
Wow.
Well, Ronald Reagan hears about it, and he goes, do they think I'm really that crazy? And here's a quote from Ronald Reagan, what do they have that I want anyway? And that's a quote. And
yeah.
He starts back-channeling just days after that I'm not crazy, I'm not going to nuke you. We have to find out areas where we have mutual agreement that we can work on things together. And there's a 10-week period between his last speech by his Deputy Secretary of State, Dam is his last name, and had the very aggressive rhetoric about the Russians. Now, 10 weeks later, Ronald Reagan, and this is the genius where I think of Ronald Reagan, he completely changed his stance. And you can actually read, there's a great book called The Reagan Reversal, about the 10 weeks where he completely changed his tone, and then 15 months later, we know who surfaces, Gorbachev.
Right.
So, if it weren't for Abel Archer, the whole Cold War could have kept heating up.
Right.
And just to let your listeners know, in October of 2015, the whole Abel Archer analysis became public in the National Security Archives. The way I described it, it's even worse if I were to read it right from the document. And then we have a publication. I actually met with that author.
Mm-hmm.
Nate Jones, and discussed his book regarding those declassified documents that are now public.
Wow. Let's go with this. I want you to express how important your dad's work is, because, you know, while we haven't yet described maybe what his job is, you made this statement in your book, and it's really impressive. I've often wondered what my dad's brain could have developed had he really been allowed to. He might have beaten Bill Gates in software development by 20 years, but once you're in the infrastructure of the top secret world, you just don't walk away. Then again, heck, maybe the world would have been blowed itself up if he had not been there. So was he a pretty important guy, or just one of the, you know,
well,
tag-alongs?
You know, it's interesting you read that quote. I periodically will just open up the book and read a page wherever I end up. That page ended up 2 days ago for me to read again. And I've often thought about that. From all the analysis and research, it was his group. It was our group. He never said it was me or I. He was responsible for the... If I found a business card with his name on it, it'd be this. Process Control Systems Engineer focusing on the delivery of ballistic missiles. So in other words, he had to have the ability to not only receive the codes, then be able to program the codes to the computers that then in turn launch the missiles. That's an incredibly complex set of sequences.
Mm-hmm.
Because now you're talking guidance systems. They even say now that without the Federal Systems Group, there would not have been a space race or a moon landing. They were that critical. So that internal group within the Federal Systems Group, so there's a regular Federal Systems Group that did government contracts with IBM. But
right. Within
the Federal Systems Group was the computer, what they call systems process controls. And that's how important it is. And he always, my neighbor who I've been talking to is 93.
Right.
And he goes, I could never figure out what your dad did for a living. And he's a very brilliant PhD, head of all sciences at San Jose State University. And he goes, and he always traveled in a black limousine with three people in it. Never four, never two. He goes, always the guy in the back seat would get out of the car first and do a 360 to kind of survey the lay of the land.
Mm-hmm.
And then my dad would get out. And he told me, this is as of 2 weeks ago, it goes, it really bothered him because I couldn't figure out what in the world he was doing. And then he goes, I knew something was up when he said he had to do some work in building a water dam in Iran. And he goes, you, the family, moved to Switzerland 6 months later. So he goes, now I knew he was really in it now.
Yeah.
So just with the security of him traveling, I like to look at him as the epicenter of the whole process of that thing, of the whole code thing being disseminated. And I even think about it today. You know, we saw Clapper yesterday become very public, being very leery of Trump's ability because he has the ability to access the codes.
Right.
So,
well, okay. Let me interrupt right there. This is really interesting, and the more you talk, the more questions that come to my mind. But we've already hit the midpoint of the program, and so we are going to go to a break here. But first, what is you have a website, right?
Missileman.net.
Missileman.net, folks. And folks, if you go to the Prophecy Hour page and you go to the pastor's page on the right, you'll find some links for this and to the book. World Net Daily published the book. When did this just came out? What? How long ago?
Well, it was supposed to be launched on August the 8th, but Amazon started shipping like on the 20th of July.
Yeah, well, that's Amazon, you know. Yeah, I know how they are. Well, amen. So I pray this book goes good, but we'll talk more when we get back. We got to go for 3 minutes, folks. We'll be right back.
Dan will be right back.
Well, we're back. This is Pastor Dan Catlin, and excuse me. We're back. This is Pastor Dan Catlin. You're listening to Messiah's Branch Prophecy Hour on the American Voice Radio Network. I'm sorry, folks. I got a little choked there, but we're on talk radio. And just real quickly, why should you support talk radio? I mean, that's really a good question. President Trump just said in his speech the other night was that without social media, he wouldn't even have been elected. In fact, his whole speech was very good. And, of course, the mainstream media, for several reasons, attacked him one after another of the things that he said. But here's the point. And you see, they don't want you to know the truth. And so if it were not for the internet and were not for talk radio, you wouldn't know the truth because mainstream media is about all of the media. Just like I had a discussion with my wife and I said something about, well, good thing for the internet. And she said, well, why? I said, well, you know, how did Trump communicate with people? And she said, well, you know, with Twitter. And I said, Twitter works by what? Oh, the internet. And I said, how do our programs go out? Well, they go out on satellite and they're on an FM station, but predominantly people listen all over the world by what? The internet. So talk radio, is a place that you can go to get I say the truth. Of course, there's some untruths on talk radio, but it is a great place to get the truth, and we need this in this day and age. Now, this program, you know, we don't sell anything. You know, while you might hear commercials or whatever, that's the station plan. But this program does not sell anything. Our mission, church, none of it. We do not sell anything. And so pray about supporting talk radio. Pray about a donation for radio and, of course, for the Wichita Ministry Church. We really need your help. So if you want to donate to radio, please let us know your donation is for that. Remember, we care for people that the Father sends us, men, women, and children from all walks of life. We get no help from any organized churches or government agencies. It's only folks like you that have supported us that we're now in our 18th year of the Wichita Mission Church work. And as for talk radio, we've been doing talk radio since 2001. And yes, we minister to people in a part of town that most people do not even like to drive through after dark. In fact, the city of Wichita has just okayed doubling the patrol right in our area. And when they talk about this on TV or the radio or put it out in news, they talk about the South Broadway corridor. That's exactly where we're at. But isn't that where the body of Messiah should be, is among the sinners, just as Yeshua was? Well, right now, we're in what the ministries call a summer slump in donations. And that should start to go away because school is back in now. But let's go to the fact. Why do so many people come to us for help? I mean, really, we're just a small place. Well, love is the answer, and they're treated like family. Beyond that, we don't have any set guidelines like programs. The only programs we have are radio programs. People walk in the door and ask for what they need. And if we don't have a way to fill it in, we pray it in. This is why even the agencies tell their employees about the Father's Little Mission Church. You see, when guidelines stop them from helping, they send people to us. People who have millions of dollars in their budget send people to a place that really has no budget. We are the last hope for so many. And we are responsible to care one for another, as we are our brother's keepers. All donations, no matter what size, helps. And the Father notices all donations that come from where? Your heart. If you don't wish to help with the poor, again, consider a donation for radio airtime, as it's not free. And donations keep us on the air. And yes, we still have not completely recovered from the storm, so we still need your help with that. You can donate online or mail a check or money order, and you can find all this information at prophecyhour.com. That's prophecyhour.com. Okay, and now we're back. We have a really, really interesting subject going on tonight. We're talking with John Clausen, talking about his book and his dad, Wallace Clausen, who worked maintaining the IBM, well, worked for IBM, but he maintained nuclear missile systems. So back to you, John. Are you there with me?
I sure am.
I am really just fascinated by this whole thing. In fact, when I opened the book and I was kind of, well, you know, this could be interesting, but you just keep me to it all the way through it. Amen. You started off by telling the folks how you found out. Maybe we ought to pick back up with that.
Okay. I'm going to start when I was physically relocated from Laguna Niguel, which is south of L.A. in Orange County. I was with Johnson & Johnson, and they said, John, we want you now to move to New Jersey. And my father had helped me put the yard in, all the concrete work we poured, all the sprinkler system, all the wood sash we put in the house in Laguna. So I was a bit afraid to call my dad and say, Dad, I'm now moving to outside the outskirts of Princeton, New Jersey. And my dad goes, oh, Johnny, that's a great place. And I was shocked. I thought he was going to show his, not anger, but frustration. But mm-hmm. He goes, oh, Johnny. Now, I did not correlate. My dad even knew the Princeton area. Well, he came out on one of my house hunting trips, and he helped me look at that property where we built a fence. And when he was, like we talked about, he was telling me about the 10 men who sat at the YMCA. The following morning, the way his tone was like a metronome hitting. Johnny, I want to tell you how I got recruited and what had happened. And he had talked about how he had gotten in a severe auto accident, and he hit his head. And the family expected him to die. He had a gigantic gash on the side of his face, and they didn't even bother taking him to the doctor. They just figured he was going to die. There was virtually no money. It was on a Sunday after church. They laid him down, and my grandmother started a prayer vigil. And miraculously, 2 days later, he came out of his coma. And it's called acquired savant syndrome. It's incredibly rare. The world's leading expert on acquired savant syndrome is an MD out of the University of Wisconsin. He said he's only met 16 post-savant geniuses. In other words, something happens where they get physically hit or some sort of trauma. They had a guy who had never even been around the piano, got hit, and now could play Mozart.
Wow.
Another gentleman was in a bar brawl and got hit, and he ended up being a mathematical whiz. So not only after my dad was hit was he a theoretical savant, but he was a mechanical savant as well. That's very, very, very rare. A lot of theoretical savants can't tie their shoelaces.
Right.
And here, and this is why my father was such a unique in his capabilities and why the government was so concerned about keeping him secret is because he's like a one-man stop nuclear shop.
Right.
And if he were to be turned, that would be trouble. Because you're involved with the whole sequencing process from how the nuclear bomb actually works, how fission turns into a chain reaction, and what you need to do to get the explosion, and then you got to figure out how to deliver it. Now, that is not an easy thing to do. So when the Germans first discovered the chain reaction and... to your female listeners, it was started by a lady by the name of Liza Meitner out of Germany, a Jewish woman living under Hitler. And they really didn't give her the credit she properly deserved. One of the cohorts who actually did the experiment, he was awarded a Nobel Prize later on. But to appease the Meitner family, they named an element after her. 30 or 40 years later, I would like to see proper recognition be given to her. She had to flee.
Yeah, absolutely.
And ended up in Sweden. But what was important to understand, that was a full year that the Germans had already been working on the calculations before FDR is even informed that there's this potential of this superpower.
Okay, stop. Let me ask you something. Really, now this is something I've seen. Sometimes TV programs, you know, in old war movies, they say, okay, he almost had the bomb, didn't have the bomb. So we're going to hear now really whether or not he honestly could have blown us off the map, maybe?
Well, they had not developed a bomb yet, but they were working on the source of the fuel. In Germany, they called it a heavy water plant.
Mm-hmm.
That was already in the works before FDR is even informed about what this new potential power is. And it came in the source of three letters, one from Einstein, another one, a physicist by the last name of Sachs, and the other one, his last name is Slizard. And it was at that time when FDR goes, boy, I guess we better do something. Well, it wasn't until the National Academies of Sciences, they were assessing who are the top mathematicians in America, because we've got to recruit them, because we have to find out who these folks are who can make weapons of warfare, but it'd be the nerds, though. It's, in other words, it's scientists who build weapons.
Right.
And as we know, the German U-boats were having a field day with the ships even trying to get to and from the continent. Well, my father was in the initial top secret organization called the NDRC, National Defense Resource Committee. And they perfected what they called microwave radar sets. And that's what my dad did during World War II. He installed microwave radar sets in submarines, airplanes, and ships at the Jacksonville Naval Air Station. And that's how the German U-boats were eliminated or greatly reduced, because we can now exactly spot where they are. So, but under that umbrella of the NDRC was obviously a radar detection committee, and there's also a uranium committee being formed to assess the fact, can a bomb actually be made? And in the report, you can actually read it, that it goes, we assess now that we believe a super explosive, i.e. a uranium chain reaction, is more feasible than we think. Now, that report hit FDR's desk in June of 1941. Well, and now FDR wants to know, what's this fuel going to cost that we have to process? And he goes, the Brits estimate it's going to be between $1 and $500 million for 1 pound of uranium. That is beyond imagination of expensive. Up to that point, a large expenditure in this world of nuclear power and assessment was considered $30,000 to $50,000 or $80,000.
Really?
He now hears, in fact, after, so in other words, FDR now approves the bomb to be built in October of 1941. He actually approves it. Now, remember, this is 60, 70 days before Pearl Harbor. The bomb has been approved before Pearl Harbor. Well, he has to find a funding source. He's got to be able to determine, because we later find out, right after Pearl Harbor, they take the building of the atomic bomb and they shove it over to the Army Corps of Engineers. Now, the military doesn't have to say anything to anybody about what they're doing. And they built, even to this day, the world's most expensive structure ever been built in the history of the world was built at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It's called the K-25 plant. It's the size of 45 football fields.
Wow.
And they had 100,000 workers there. Nobody knew what they were doing, ultimately working on. They were processing the fuel. Now, if you want to look at the building of a bomb as like an income statement in business, 85% of the cost of building a bomb is the fuel. $512 million today is $10 billion now. I cannot find a single structure that cost $10 billion to build. And Congress had no idea this was being built. And if you look at the budget, World War II, depending how you deal with fixed expenses, 18 to 20% of the entire World War II budget was allocated for building the atomic bomb. And 85% of it was for the fuel. That's what people don't seem to, you got to understand, the expensive part is the fuel.
Right.
Now, that is incredibly large percentage. Now, this is the way I'd like your listeners to. So in October, the 60 days before Pearl Harbor, a war was started called the War of Physics. Very few people know about it, but it's the ability to develop the chain reaction in the fuel. World War II was the funding source for building of the atomic bomb. And that is well documented, that the person responsible for building the atomic bomb is a gentleman by the name of Henry Stimson.
Mm-hmm.
His nephew, in the 30s, before the government stepped in, was personally bankrolling a lot of these top scientists in their atom research. His name is Alf Loomis. Fascinating guy. He assessed the stock market as it was going to collapse, so he pulled all his money out. He pulled out $200 to $300 million before the collapse, and that's a billionaire today,
right?
Multi-billionaire, and He's personally funding it. Now, here's what's, and the head of the radar committee of the NDRC is Henry, is this Loomis gentleman. Well, his son is a senior at Harvard. His dad pulls his son out of Harvard, and he makes him the head of Pearl Harbor radar installation and training. And when I read that, when he passed away, Henry Loomis, I was always thinking, there's the missing connection. So at Pearl Harbor, the head of radar is the son of the person who's the guru of all of radar, whose uncle is responsible for the building of the atomic bomb. So there's, I call it the nuclear trifecta, that you can relate it right from the White House right to Pearl Harbor with nuclear knowledge. That has never been made public before.
Right. All kinds of alarm bells are going off in my head about that. The bomb was funded by World War II, and Pearl Harbor, the question arises, did they make sure the radar worked or didn't work?
Well, that's a good, very good assessment. You can even go back to movies in the 70s, Tora, Tora, Tora.
Right.
Even that Hollywood-made movie, even they speculate in Hollywood, it's as if they were set up, which is exactly what had to happen. And even Henry Stimson, quote, in his autobiography says, I hope they hit us first, but not too hard. If that is an admission. So the son, Henry Stimson, the guy at Opana, he's only had 2 days experience working on that radar. And
right.
It's not by chance. All five of the radar stations were to be set up, so if one sees the bleep, they're all informed. They said they'll set that up after they get hit. And I write in the book, and I say, that's the equivalent of a boxer wanting to put in his mouth guard in his mouth after he's on the canvas.
Exactly.
It's a little late. Well, that was done intentionally. So there's so many little facets that you can correlate together. And now I put people who are not nuclear knowledgeable at Pearl Harbor in the training of radar. No, that's more than a coincidence.
Yeah, I'm not much of a coincidence type person anyway, but go ahead.
So the son to the uncle, who is the ultimate radar guru of the world, I can assure you that he is informing his son because his uncle is the head of the war effort. And so to have that kind of connection directly to the White House, we've broken the code. The radar is intentionally not set up where they all communicate. They closed the Office of Central Command for the radar station 6 minutes early. They knew what was happening. But now you have an unlimited funding source, and which is exactly what they needed to build the K-25 plant.
Yeah, because that's such an unheard amount of money, for even if they put it off through black ops or whatever. I don't know how that worked during World War II, but I know we have black projects now that a lot of money goes to, but nothing to that degree, you know what I'm saying? So there would have to be something dramatically able to fund that. And, you know, it looks like you hit the proverbial nail right on the head and connected the dots back to
you. Well, it's just... there are just too many coincidences, if you know what I mean. And now, after they did the K-25 plant, now they go to Hanford, Washington, and they spend another $300 to $400 million to build the Hanford plutonium site. But there is more money being spent than you can possibly imagine. So it's just important to understand that there was a bigger war. Now, here I want you to put, you have this war of physics. It basically ends, obviously we get the atomic bomb, but the Cold War, the war of physics morphs into the Cold War, which ended up costing this country $8 trillion. And now it appears that the Cold War is heating up again.
Yeah.
So you have to think of it in macro. the war of physics, it never has ended when it started in October 9th, 1941 for this country.
Right. Well, I can see that because, you know, technology, I mean, like you said earlier, you know, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. And once this knowledge is open, then, I mean, it continually goes on and more research, finding out new things and ergo need for more ways to fund it. And so now we're hearing the, you know, the Cold War back. I mean, you know, to me, it never went away, just kind of got quiet.
Sidelined for a while.
Yeah. Yeah, and it still continued on. I mean, like you say, I don't see how that could ever stop.
Did you know, after Liza Minnelli discovered the chain reaction, I mean, proved it mathematically.
Right.
They actually printed in the Naturwissenschaft magazine out of Berlin, which means natural science magazine. They actually printed how to obtain a chain reaction. They're printing it in a magazine. And then finally, after 6 months, in June of 1939, the scientists are saying, you know what, we maybe shouldn't be printing all this up. Because they talk about if you get the chain reaction to speed up and you add energy to it, you get a super explosive.
Right.
And since no one had blown one up, no one knew how big that explosion might be.
Right. Right.
And to think, FDR wasn't even informed. He was informed after that, after they stopped printing it. That's how far behind we were initially. And then, like I said, in the NDRC committee, and those documents that your listeners will be able to, we're just starting to post them now, the NDRC declassified documents as to the schools they infiltrated to do secret science work, which is what my dad is. He never really went to college, but his grades, they actually made my father, quote-unquote, make him look like the village idiot at Iowa State. He had a 1.11 GPA.
Yeah.
He had him flunking math 101. And they didn't want any hint or a trace that there was a savant amongst them at school there. And there he was working on advanced radar.
Well, you know, and you had to wonder, I mean, with your dad going away with people in black limousines and all this, you know, and we didn't even get to the heart of that, but we're really running, actually we're out of time. We're at less than a minute away from saying goodbye. Maybe we'll have to do this again. I would like to hear more of this story from you because...
I'd be happy to do it, and... just be in touch, and we'll finish the development of the website. But for your listeners out there, just keep an open mind and just ask yourself, why do you think what you do think? Because think about the Cold War. You've learned from teachers, politicians, military figures. Now an insider is spoken up and is telling his story.
Wow. Yeah, it's a fantastic story. Folks, the book is called Missile Man. You can get it from Amazon, WorldNet Daily. Go visit the site, missileman.net. And John, really, John, and this book, it's a pretty fantastic book, but he's sitting here telling us some things that we didn't know about. And you need to share this program with others. It's the first time he talked about those connections in Pearl Harbor and with the radars. I'd never heard that before. So anyway, check out the book. You can get it at Amazon. You get it at WorldNet Daily, Missile Man. And it's missileman.net. Again, I sent the link over to the pastor page at prophecyhour.com, and you'll find a link to his website there. So anyway, pray about supporting radio. We really do need your help. We need to get the studio back in shape. And the radio supports what? It supports the Wichita Mission Church and all the people that we help, thousands upon thousands of people in now our 18th year. But remember, there is only one God. He is your Father. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. His Son is Yeshua HaMashiach. He gave his life for repented sins. He rose after 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And through him, and only through him, is the way to the Father. Remember, always be what? a blessing to others. Of course, how could you not be a blessing to others if you were you are indeed born again and have Yeshua in you, or the Holy Spirit? Anyway, Lord our God, Father King Universe, asking Yeshua HaMashiach's name, that Father, that you would bless and keep them, and that your face would shine upon them, and that you would be gracious to them and give you peace, give them peace like no one or nothing else can. Until an hour from now, this is Pastor Dan saying goodbye and shalom.
You've just heard the Messiah's Branch broadcast featuring Pastor Dan. To contact Dan on the internet, go to messiahsbranch.org. To write to Dan, send a note to Messiah's Branch, 230 West 4th Street, Florence, Kansas, 66851. Tune in next time for Messiah's Branch.